Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another episode in my mystery series, where today I want to talk to you about a case often named the Lost Boys of Pickering, or the Missing Boys of Pickering, or the Missing Six. In March 1995, six teenage boys vanished after a night out partying, with investigators believing they had stolen boats at a nearby marina and met their fates on the lake. But no trace of the boys or the boats have ever been found. Over the past 27 years, there's been more questions than answers, and with each look into this case, more mysteries begin to arise. Nothing much about this story makes any sense, and their families are desperate for closure, for an understanding about what happened to their sons. This is a case with very few answers, just lots of speculation, lots of questions and theories. I try not to speculate too much in my videos and instead just present the hard evidence, so I don't think wild speculation is ever helpful for the families or for investigators. But in cases like this, speculation is kind of all you have. We'll definitely ponder on some possibilities about what happened on the lake that night, and hopefully that will lead to some interesting discussion in the comments. This is a case with surprisingly little information available on the internet, but I've done my best to find solid sources where I can. In 2012, a private investigator called Bruce Ricketts, who specialises in cold cases, started working closely with the families here, and it seems that he's looked more into this case than anyone else, especially in the past decade. There's a Facebook page called The Lost Boys of Pickering where the public are kept updated on any new developments in this case. And Bruce also did a really informative interview on Jason Hebert's YouTube channel in which he gives a rundown of the case as it stands today. So I'd say those were my main sources for this video and they'll be linked down below as always. Also, my throat's a little bit sore today, I'm a little bit croaky, so please don't mind that. This is the story of the disappearances of six boys, 18-year-old Chad Smith and 17-year-olds Jay Boyle, Robbie Rumbolt, Jamie Lefebvre, Michael Cummins and Danny Higgins. All of them were from Pickering, Ontario, or the towns immediately surrounding it, and Pickering is a city located in southern Ontario in the Durham region in Canada, about 30 miles east of Toronto. According to the 1996 census, it had a population of just under 79,000 people at this time, so it was a fairly sizable place. And whilst I would love to be able to go into detail about each of these boys, share with you their personalities, their likes and their dislikes, their family lives, this information sadly just isn't freely available on the internet as far as I can find. While some of the family members have gone as public as they can, fighting for justice and closure in this case, other families have stayed in the shadows, I'm sure working behind the scenes or just trying to move on with their lives. Both responses to something like this are completely valid, but it does mean that we know more about the lives of some of the boys than others. It doesn't mean that any more important, just some have been publicised more. As Linda Higgins, Danny's mother, told DurhamRegion.com, some of the boys' families have either moved away from Pickering or they stay away because it's too hard to come back to the place where their friends, brothers or sons disappeared. Other families like to stay close, to stay connected. On the evening of the 16th of March 1995, the friends had all attended a basement party in Pickering, the drink flowing freely in celebration of St. Patrick's Day and it being spring break. Some sources do suggest that Danny Higgins might not have been at the party that night, but he was picked up by his friends after they left. And whilst it's known that they definitely were drinking that night, it's never been clear exactly how drunk they were. The other attendees at the party have never been all too open about what happened that night, worried that they would get in trouble themselves for underage drinking, I'm sure. The legal drinking age in Ontario has been 19 since 1971. There's also suggestions that drugs were also being taken at this party, weed and possibly harder drugs, so people have stayed fairly quiet. It was a Thursday night in their March break from school and the boys were doing what so many teenagers do, drinking and partying. The boys left the party about 12:40 a.m. on March 17th, after telling a friend that they had plans to go and goof around on a boat. Sure enough, just over an hour later, at 1:48 a.m, a surveillance camera catches three of the boys, Michael, Jamie and Robbie, entering the East Shore Marina at Frenchman's Bay, the water leading directly into Lake Ontario on the North Shore. They were seen in this footage taking beer for one of the small boats docked there. From my googling, Frenchman's Bay seems like a really beautiful place, but it does seem like a bit of rejuvenation work has gone on there in the last year. Trying to figure out the vibe of the place, I went onto TripAdvisor, where the most recent review reads, "Cute neighbourhood by the water with small shops, a waterfront walkway and lakefront beach. Great photo opportunities with a nuclear power plant as a background." And that seems to sum up perfectly. It seems like people like to go there and spend their evenings there to watch the sunset. In the summer it's a bit of a retreat for boat lovers, there's live music, etc. But that's all recent, obviously. I will assume though that the vibe might have been similar back in 1995. But we do know for sure it seems to have been a place that teenagers like to hang out and get up to mischief in the night time. And that's what these boys were doing, it seems, getting up to mischief. So we know this surveillance footage of the three boys at the marina that night definitely exists. The family was shown it the next day when they reported their sons as missing. But when the families later asked to see it again, police denied having it. And this is a theme you'll see repeated throughout this story. For reasons that have never really been entirely clear, investigators have always been shady about this case. Why would they lie and say they don't have the footage when clearly at one point they did? Was it incompetent and they lost it, or was it something else? That's just the tip of the iceberg in this case, but the teenagers would never be seen again after this point, after they were seen taking the beer out of this small boat. After the boys never returned to the party that night, a couple of their girlfriends got concerned and went to the police to report that the boyfriends were missing, but they were brushed off by police saying that boys will be boys and advised them to get hold of their mothers who could file official reports in the morning. The girls, knowing the boys had gone to the lake, were worried that something bad had happened. Perhaps if they'd been taken seriously straight away, I wouldn't be here sharing this story. Perhaps the boys would have been found, lost and floating on the lake. But then again, teenage boys, teenage girls can get up to mischief. They can go exploring and reappear several hours later unharmed. I'm sure the police received plenty of calls where the situation turned out to be just that. But these girlfriends just had a gut feeling that something wasn't right. Jay Boyle had four sisters, and his 15-year-old sister Amanda was supposed to go to the same party that night, but she was sick and stayed at home instead. The next morning, Amanda heard from Jay's girlfriend, who he lived with and had a baby with. She said that Jay had never come home. Amanda said to Kristen Callis for DurhamRegion.com, "At first I wasn't too worried because Jay had a tendency, not that he'd take off, but he had friends in Toronto too. He would go to Toronto, but he always kept in touch. But of course Jay hadn't gone to Toronto, he never came home. Soon it became clear that something bad must have happened. According to those who loved him, Jay would never have abandoned his family and his newborn daughter. To this day, Jay's sisters have never stopped searching and fighting for him." So the police didn't take the boys' disappearances seriously until their parents returned the next day, at which point they make the connection to a report that had come in that morning of two boats that had been stolen from two separate marinas in this area, a Boston Whaler replica boat and a water pedal aquabike, which is also known as a water tricycle. The aquabike is probably something you've seen before. It basically looks like a tricycle with those three massive wheels. You pedal it yourself and you'll often see them on lakes on summer's days. People can rent them to go out on the water. By their very nature, the fact that they're often used by tourists or non-professional boaters, they're not particularly meant to be easy to capsize or to fall off of. The Boston Whaler, however, was more of a significant actual boat. It's a 4 meter long fiberglass boat. Interestingly, a Boston Whaler is considered to be almost unsinkable because of its foam core. It's used by lifeguards, etc., and is even said to remain unsinkable even if it's been cut in half or filled with water. By 2 p.m. on the Saturday, so now 36 hours after the boys had last been seen, a massive search on the lake was underway, finally. After speaking to some people who kept their boats on the marina and some local residents, investigators found that between 2:30 and 3 a.m. some people had heard a motorboat out on the lake. Now, it's worth noting that there's no footage, no evidence of the boys taking either of these missing boats. It's just a fact that the boys went missing and so did these boats on the same night. And so a lot of people put two and two together, rightly or wrongly. We do not know for certain the boys stole both or either of these vessels. This is just circumstantial evidence at best. But let me share a bit of information about this lake because the context is quite important. Lake Ontario is one of the five Great Lakes of North America on the USA/Canada border. Ontario, Canada in the north, west and southwest, New York, USA on the south and east. The boundary between the countries literally runs through the middle of the lake. Lake Ontario is the easternmost of the Great Lakes, and whilst it is the smallest in surface area, covering only 7,340 square miles, it does exceed Lake Erie in volume, making it the 14th largest lake in the world. When stood on the shoreline, you can't see the other side. It looks and feels like a vast ocean of water, with its own beaches and marinas along the shoreline. It's also incredibly deep, with an average depth of 86 metres and a maximum depth of 244 metres. Note that deep diving is defined as going any deeper than 20 metres, so for somebody to be able to dive to 244 metres would require incredible skill and bravery. It's not something that most people can do, but it's not impossible. And this lake never completely freezes because it's so deep, even in the cold, cold Canada weather. The surface of Lake Ontario has only frozen over around five times in recorded history, the last time in 1934, and that's important to note because this happened in March in Canada. Just coming out of the winter, the lake wouldn't have been frozen, but there may well have been chunks of ice floating on the surface. On the night in question here, the weather was 39 degrees Fahrenheit, so approximately 4 degrees Celsius. It was a bit chilly, but they definitely would have seen worse weather in Ontario and the boys would have been used to weather like this. The lake would have been colder than this though, and it's estimated that anyone who fell into the lake wouldn't have been able to survive much more than 60 seconds, quickly succumbing to hypothermia. The police search for the boys was short but intense. It involved several different police forces and the military, but it was called off not long after it began on the 20th of March. According to an article on Medium by Nikki Young, Durham police were joined by the Toronto Police Marine Unit, the Coast Guard, a Hercules C-130 aircraft, and a helicopter from the Air Sea Rescue Unit. Thousands of volunteers from across Ontario also joined in on the search, but literally nothing was found. No sign of the missing boats, no scraps of clothing, no floating beer bottles, no floating bodies, nothing. A day later, the search was called off, with police hypothesising that the boys had gone out for a joyride, the boats had capsized, and the boys had either drowned or quickly succumbed to hypothermia in the freezing lake. And that was it, that was the answer. But we all know that provides more questions than it does actual answers. If this had happened, where were the bodies? And where were the boats? Had the boys all drowned, they would have sank at first, but as their bodies decomposed, chances are they would have eventually come back up to the surface. Even if the bodies got caught on something in the lake, debris or seaweed or something, all six of them getting caught by some sort of bad luck, surely their clothing would have resurfaced as they further decomposed, but not a single item of clothing has ever been found. And in what kind of scenario would all the boys have drowned in this way? There were two boats missing that night. If you're going with the police's theory that the boys went out on the lake on the stolen or missing boats, you could probably assume that there were boys on both boats. How did both boats manage to capsize and go missing? Did some of the boys fall in and the others jumped in to help them without thinking? How has not a single body or a body part ever surfaced? It's not like the boys were weighted down, none of the clothing they were wearing was particularly heavy. And it's probably worth noting at this point as well that the boat it seems they took had no life jackets on board, so chances are they were not wearing life jackets. There's a saying about another one of the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, that she never gives up her dead. I've done a whole other video around that topic if you're interested, but could the same be said for Lake Ontario? Well, it certainly seems like plenty of bodies are found in, on, or on the shoreline of the lake, but just as many do go missing. It's said that thousands of people in Pickering have stories of people they knew who died in the lake. You are allowed to swim in the lake, it has many beaches, but you've got to know how to stay safe. You've got to be sensible. Even if the surface looks calm, you go out too deep and the strong currents underneath could pull you under. But let's say these boys did go out in a boat, something happened, maybe one fell in, then everyone else fell in trying to help, and they all ended up in the water. Not a single piece of evidence of any of their bodies appearing in 27 years? It's unbelievable. Not impossible, perhaps, but definitely unbelievable. Which brings us to the question surrounding the boat, particularly the imitation Boston Whaler. Where are the boats? Boston Whalers, as I mentioned earlier, are said to be unsinkable. They're used by river and lake patrols because they're stable and easy to drive. And although this one was an imitation, a replica, they're also said to be near enough unsinkable as well. They're modelled very, very closely. For a boat like this one to go down, there would have had to have been a significant leak, and even then it likely would have taken a number of hours according to what I've read online. Of course though, I know very little about boats and I am taking this information at face value. If you're more of an expert, I would love to hear your input in the comments. Even if this boat rocked in heavy currents and threw people off of it, the boat itself likely would have remained floating. Which again raises the question, where are the boats? Over the past 27 years, no one has ever reported seeing either boat, the Whaler or the Tricycle, wash up on the shores or floating in the distance. Could it be that the boats did wash up eventually and somebody found them or one of them claiming a free boat for themselves? I mean, if it's in good condition and you haven't heard of anyone searching for a missing boat, maybe you would just take it for yourself, maybe paint it or sell it on. I can't say I personally would, but I bet there's a lot of people out there who would do just that. A big point in this case that we'll come back round to eventually, I'm sure, is that whilst this case was pretty big in Canada, it was in the news, there are missing persons posters, people generally knew of the missing teens, it never did quite reach that same level of notoriety in the USA, even though New York was just the other side of the lake. Maybe the boat floated over there eventually and a New Yorker found it, claiming it for themselves, and then maybe a while later they did hear of this case and made the connection to the boat they'd found. They wouldn't necessarily come forward, worried that they'd get in trouble or be implicated in a crime. You can't underestimate how huge this lake is, the remote places this boat could turn up. This USA-Canada point is also important to bear in mind in terms of communication between police forces. Could it be that a body or items of clothing did wash up on the New York side of the lake and communication about it never quite reached Canada? I don't know, perhaps I'd be more inclined to believe that if we were talking the 60s or the 70s, but going into the 90s, technology was improving, communication was improving, and I refuse to believe there was an agency designated for this kind of communication. A lot of crimes or missing people must happen on this lake, on Lake Ontario, and people would need assistance on both sides of the water. There must be communication. There was one single piece of evidence found in the aftermath, and that was a red Yamaha gas tank, or gas container I suppose, found near Wilson, New York, which is almost directly south of Pickering on the opposite side of the lake. The gas can was found to be floating upside down on the shoreline of the lake, and it was later identified as having been on the stolen boat. The tank was identified by a yard manager at the marina who identified it via a very small dent, which raises questions in itself. He must have seen multiple gas tanks every day, all of which would have looked very, very similar. Would he really have paid attention to a small dent on one of them? The investigators certainly believed that this gas tank was definitely from the missing boat though, so I wonder if there's another piece of information that they've held back there. The tank was said to have had about 25 miles worth of gas inside, which wouldn't have got the boys very far if they were indeed on that boat. The lake is 53 miles wide, so this gas tank could have got them to about the middle of the lake, but who's to say they would just sail directly out towards the middle? I'm not much of a thrill seeker, I will admit, but if that were me, I'd purposely want to stay in sight of the shoreline at all times. Two of the boys are said to have been experienced boaters, so they would have known to check the gas, but saying that, they were all drunk and so not thinking as logically as a sober person probably would do. The cap to this gas tank was missing, and as I said, it was found floating upside down with no water having filled the tank in the time between the boys disappearing and the tank being found. However, the tank had been found 14 days after disappearance. So what are the chances the tank didn't roll and fill in that time at all? Is it a possibility that it hadn't been in the water for that long at all? This information I've taken from the Lost Boys Pickering Facebook page, but it does make for some very interesting points. The gas can was found directly south of Pickering, as I said, but it seems strange that the current and the winds would take it in that direction. Naturally, it would have likely been taken out further east. The weather on the night the boys disappeared is said to have been fairly calm in a lot of the sources I've read, or at least it would have looked calm to an untrained eye. One commenter on, I think it was Reddit, noted that they were a fisherman on the lake and they were interviewed by police in the aftermath of this case. He remembers that there was actually quite a strong wind, and although the water would have seemed calm to somebody inexperienced, as you got towards the centre of the lake, it would have been quite choppy. This is a point towards maybe the boys getting in trouble on the boat, but that doesn't make sense that the gas tank would travel directly south to Wilson. It's not known if investigators ever dusted the gas tank for prints on the off chance that they hadn't been washed away. There is a lot of speculation online about this tank. It's said that it was kept afloat because of an air pocket inside. It wasn't filled with water. Perhaps the boat sank with this tank aboard, but I can't see any scenario in which the tank would have been upside down on the boat, especially seeing as it didn't have its cap on. This gas is what runs the boat. The engine simply doesn't work without it. It would have had to have been manually removed off the boat to have ended up in the water. It wouldn't have just detached itself if the boat sank. The Facebook page speculates that the tank ran dry of gas and one of the boys opened it to make sure it was empty before disconnecting it from the engine. As I said, two of the boys were experienced boaters, so they would have known what to check for. Perhaps in their frustration, the tank was thrown into the lake, landing directly upside down. Others think that one of the boys could have gone overboard and the tank was thrown into the lake for them to use as some sort of buoy to hold on to. There's no way this tank could have ended up floating in the water without it being manually detached in some way, and there had to have been a reason that it had been detached. If this red gas tank was indeed the one that was on board the Boston Whaler when it was taken, it had certainly run empty at some point, it seems. But then again, that's all just speculation. And of course, all of this only covers one of the boats that had gone missing. The other, the water tricycle, didn't require a gas tank to move. You had to manually pedal it. The theory the police work with is that some of the boys took out the Boston Whaler, others took out the water tricycle. But the tricycle wouldn't be able to move as fast or as far as the actual boat. The boys would have got tired quickly of pedalling, so they must have stayed relatively near the shoreline even if they were on a joyride. It would have been incredibly difficult to capsize or sink this water tricycle. The wheels are essentially flotation devices. You're telling me that both of these relatively unsinkable boats happened to individually run into trouble and sink. How? The only things we know for sure in this case are that the boys went missing that night, two boats were stolen, and a gas tank was found near Wilson. They are the only solid facts that we have. Everything else is speculation. Perhaps we'd have more if a more thorough investigation had been conducted, but sadly, the search for the boys was called off incredibly quickly. On top of that, no underwater searches were ever conducted. It's been found that one local company did receive a contract from Durham Police to sonar scan the area around the marina and the lake as part of the search, but that contract was quickly cancelled for no apparent reason. When the police gave up on the search, the families were left to conduct their own searches on their own, but there's only so much you can do. You can't search water like you can search land. Nothing would happen in this case for years. Many years later, it would transpire that on the 10th of April 1998, so just over 3 years after the boys went missing, police were called to the Sir Adam Beck Hydroelectric Generating Station in Queenston, next to the Niagara River. So this is very near Wilson, New York, on the opposite side of Lake Ontario to Pickering. Two sets of human remains have been found whilst they were cleaning out grates in the forebay, and this was the first time they'd been cleaned in 7 years, so there's no way of knowing how long these two bodies had been there. There's very limited information online about this situation, and we only really know the details of one of the bodies, and to be honest, body is stretching the truth a little bit. Whilst a police detective referred to the body as bones, plural, it's unclear just how many bones there were. It definitely wasn't a full body, and many sources refer to just one long bone. The whole situation here was one or more bones, a pair of red jeans, a black belt, some socks, and a wallet with no contents. After this body was discovered, the evidence was taken into custody by Niagara River Police and 17 days later was sent to Hamilton General Hospital for autopsy, or at least as much of an autopsy as you can do with just a couple of bones. The testing concluded that the bones were from somebody between the ages of 25 to 60, and that was pretty much it, that was all they can tell. And the families of the missing boys over in Pickering weren't ever told of what had been found. Investigators would later justify this by saying that the location of where the bones and the jeans were found could not have been any of the missing boys, as it defied physics. And I suppose I need to give you a bit of context here on location. So almost directly south of Pickering, only about 12 miles west of Wilson, where the gas tank had been found floating, is where Lake Ontario becomes the mouth of the Niagara River. Yes, the Niagara River, responsible for Niagara Falls. A few miles down the river is the hydroelectric station where the body would eventually be found. A constable, Rich Gadreau, with Niagara Police said, "Since the jeans were found above the falls, there really is no chance it could be Boyle. If bodies were to make it there from the lake, they would be below the falls." There's a reason J. Boyle is specifically mentioned here, just give me a second to get there. Niagara River, very interestingly, actually travels north, which is quite unusual apparently. It flows from Lake Erie up to Lake Ontario. With the direction of the current, I do understand why authorities say it's physically impossible for the bone found at the hydro station to be any of the boys. If they had disappeared from Lake Erie, then yes, this would make sense. But to get there from Lake Ontario, they would have literally had to have travelled against a very strong current. However, that's going by the theory that the boys did go out on the boats that night and somehow ended up in the water. But what if that's not what happened at all? What if they made it across the lake? What if they decided to go on more of an adventure and somehow they ended up the other side of the lake? Plenty of people die in these lakes, don't get me wrong, these bones could have belonged to anyone. Except, on the night that he went missing, Jay Boyle was wearing red jeans, very similar to the ones found, and they were the same size as him, a 32 waist. Red jeans nowadays aren't exactly the most common item of clothing, but we have got to bear in mind that this was the 90s and they may well have been more popular back then, so it's not crazy to think that two people could have disappeared in the river or in the lakes wearing red jeans. In 1998, the Niagara River Police Department described the trousers they'd found as red Levi denim jeans, and they certainly do look like they were, the trademark V-shaped stitching on the pocket, an extra belt loop, and the orange tag on the back pocket, all indicators of Levi brand at this time. However, in a 2014 coroner's report by a Dr. Grispierre, it stated that they couldn't be red Levi jeans from the 90s and they had originally been misidentified, describing the jeans instead as orange. But of course, water damage would have faded the colour and they do seem to have all the hallmarks of Levi jeans. Despite these jeans and the remains being found in 1998, the Boyles didn't find out about this case until approximately 8 years ago, when his sister was looking at the Ontario Provincial Police Missing Persons page and she found out about it. She remembered immediately that Jay was wearing red jeans on the night he disappeared, of which there was actual photographic evidence, and she knew that further investigation needed to be done. If there was any chance this was her brother, she was going to find out. She set up a change.org petition to get the police to DNA test these remains, but this would be a battle that would last many years, with the police saying it couldn't possibly be him, so they weren't going to do it, basically. Bruce Ricketts, the private investigator, eventually released a statement saying that repeated requests from the Boyle family for DNA analysis to be performed on the unidentified body had been refused by the Niagara Police. However, the Niagara Police said they never received such a request, saying it was Durham Police's investigation. Of course, the Durham Police were dealing with the missing six boys, but the Niagara Police were dealing with these unidentified remains. There was a bit of a jurisdiction communication issue, it seems. The Boyle family offered to pay for the DNA testing themselves, but this whole situation was strange, with the police being unquestionably shady about the DNA testing of the remains. Why? We don't really know. There was confusion as to who was actually in possession of these remains. There was confusion over the file number. There were so many bureaucratic hoops to jump through. Bruce said it has never been as difficult to get hold of case files as it was in this case. And when Bruce was eventually able to get his hands on the police reports about these remains, a huge amount of the report was redacted, making it basically useless. The police said it was for privacy reasons, but the privacy of who? This person is unidentified. Why would the police want to put up roadblocks to getting this person identified? Bruce raised some interesting questions about the contradictions surrounding these remains and the clothing. He questions if the remains recovered in 1998 are even the same ones that were viewed by the anthropologist in 2014. Why would they be so sure that the trousers were red Levi's, originally giving a very detailed description, and then the anthropologist denies this, giving a completely different description of the trousers in her report? Someone is wrong here for sure, but we just don't know who or why. Police have admitted that the evidence got lost for quite a while. Nobody was really sure where it was kept after the autopsy in 1998, so there is very much a chain of custody issue surrounding all this. Who was looking after the evidence in this time, and how can we be sure that it was all kept in good forensic condition? How can we trust that the bones they have now were the same as the ones from 1998? It sounds like a crazy conspiracy to suggest that the bones could have been switched, I know that. But because there's no chain of custody here, because it disappeared for so long without record and then was suddenly found and given to a coroner in 2014, there's no way of knowing that didn't happen, and that causes problems. The petition started by Jay's sister to get the remains DNA tested eventually gathered around 50,000 signatures, and it did eventually happen. Since Jay's birth, his mum had kept a piece of his umbilical cord safe, which she submitted in order to create Jay's DNA profile to be compared against the bones found at the hydro station, but in 2018 the results came back. It was not a match. And as you can imagine, this was a huge blow to everyone. But even the fact they'd been able to test this DNA was confusing, as for a long time the family had been told there wasn't enough remains to test for DNA. Then all of a sudden they were like, we can do it. Perhaps advances in modern technology is the answer here, but it was a very quick turnaround from no, we absolutely cannot test this DNA, to oh, no we can, it's not Jay. For 4 years, a lot of people had pinned all their hopes on this match, down to the matching jeans, and his sister even claimed that the belt and socks looked similar to ones that Jay owned. But now, apparently, it wasn't him, which I think came as quite a shock to everyone involved. But this wasn't the end of it for the people fighting. As I've already pointed out, Bruce isn't convinced the bone tested against Jay's DNA was even the one that was found back in 1998. This was an issue raised on the Lost Boys of Pickering Facebook page in March 2018, 9 months before the negative results even came back. They pointed out saying the issue was not the DNA testing, it's what they're testing the DNA on. But taking the information we have at present on face value, these remains were not Jay's, which raises the question of whose were they? Even if it's not one of the Lost Boys, this is still a person who deserves identification. But it doesn't really seem like they've continued the search since this testing. I hope the DNA has been entered into genealogical databases where one day it will hopefully strike a match, but I don't know that for sure. In terms of solid information we have about this case, that's about where it ends. I'm sure you have as many questions as I do at this point, but there just aren't any answers. The main questions I have in regards to the police's official theory are how come only three of the boys were caught on the surveillance tape? Where were the other three? How do we know they were even there that night? The camera that caught the boys was one that sort of swiveled back and forth, so perhaps it just happened to miss the others in the movement, but it seems unlikely. There's no proof that the other three ever even arrived at the marina. I know it's pretty impossible that they would have separated and both disappeared under different circumstances, but it's just wild to me that the police are so set on the lake theory when there's so many unanswered questions. I get that on the surface it's a theory that makes the most sense. I understand why they would think in that direction, but there are families here that need closure. Along the same lines, and I spoke about this earlier, if the boys were potentially on two separate boats, how did they all end up in the water? Did one fall in and the rest try to help? There's no denying that once they were in the water, hypothermia would have got them fairly quickly, but the question is, how did they end up there? If one boat happened to sink, that doesn't mean the other one would. Maybe one of the boats sank and one or more of the boys died and the rest ran away, scared that they would face consequences. But I don't know. The families that have spoken publicly about this case find it very hard to believe that they would have disappeared with zero contact for 27 years. You've got to be one hell of a strong person, and a teenager at that. These are literally teenage boys, to be able to abandon your family like this. A lot of people think that maybe they planned all of this. They planned to run away that night, but I don't think so. It just doesn't seem right. They had no reasons to want to run away. But a potential cover-up here? That seems more plausible to me than a runaway theory. There's evidence suggests that the Durham police had a bad relationship with one or more of the boys. Jay Boyle, it seems, had definitely butted head with the law a couple of times by this point. Could this potentially have been why the police were slow to act? Maybe investigators realised they'd messed up early on and knew that if bodies were found, they could be in the firing line for not searching quick enough. Potentially it was easier for them if no bodies were ever found, so they quickly gave up on the search. I want to stress that this is only speculation. I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I have no particular names in mind while saying this. But it does seem strange that the police would give up on the search after only a day, doesn't it? 6 missing boys and a quick cursory search with no underwater investigation at all is either complete incompetence or someone not wanting something to come out. Some people on the internet speculate that the boys were involved with drugs, either taking drugs on the night in question or they were deeper involved. One poster on Facebook claimed to know Jamie LeFave, commenting, "Jamie called me around 12:15 a.m. in the morning. I was sleeping. He told me they were robbing all the yachts for booze." And I can tell you 100% that they were on LSD that night, because I was with Jamie the whole week before he disappeared and that we bought a booklet of LSD. I decided to go home and sleep that night as we were up for days. I had an angel on my shoulder that night. I don't know how legitimate this claim is. I don't know if this poster definitely knew Jamie or knew any of the boys, but a few people have seemed to claim the same thing, that at least some of these boys took hard drugs recreationally. Which leads on to speculation that they could have been involved in a drug deal gone wrong on the night in question. Did they meet up with somebody and meet their end, their bodies disposed of? Maybe they pissed off the wrong person, owed the wrong person money. I don't know, speculation. I'm not claiming all of the boys had to have been involved in something like this, but maybe just one of them and the rest were along for the ride. Maybe they'd planned to meet for a deal on the lake and it was a fairly easy location for them to get killed. Or at least it was easier than it would have been on land, which would have been a difficult task. Killing 6 boys on land? That's hard. Killing 6 boys in the middle of a lake? Probably a bit easier. Then again, if that's the case, I don't think their bodies would have been left in the water. They likely would have been removed, or they would have resurfaced by now, I'm sure. If this was the case, then undoubtedly somebody in Pickering knows more of this story. There's of course also the possibility that they never took a boat that night at all, that it was a coincidence and the boys met their fate somewhere on land. Land that was never really searched at the time because of the focus on the water. And finally, next to East Bay Marina, there's a Pickering nuclear generating station. This theory is very loose speculation at best, but I've seen some suggest that the bodies were found in the grounds of the nuclear station, and for whatever reason, privacy, dodges going on around the station, secrets around nuclear power in general, whatever it was, authorities made the decision that it was best to be covered up. Yeah, like I said, a very loose theory, but that and incompetence are the only reasons I can think of for the police's strange behaviour around this case and why the search was called off so quickly. Although I will admit that incompetence is much more likely. All the families want are answers here. Many people do think that this is a case of Occam's razor, the simplest answer being the correct one. The bodies are at the bottom of Lake Ontario. I'm not against that theory, but I do find it hard to believe that no remains, clothing, or the boats were ever found. The bodies I can believe are a stretch, but these unsinkable boats? They must have washed up somewhere, and how have they never been seen since? Maybe one would have gone down, but the other? I just don't quite believe it. How did the police just happen to lose the surveillance footage from that night? There are so many unanswered questions. And these are answers that we may well have had the police not cancelled the contract with the company about to do a sonar search of the lake. I wonder if that's too late to do now. I wonder if there's a GoFundMe that could be set up to pay for something like this to support the families. I have no idea how much something like that would cost. I'm sure it definitely wouldn't be cheap, But I'd love to know if that was even a possibility at this point. Why aren't they doing underwater searches? If the boat could be found at the bottom of the lake, then that could be our answer. The bodies may well be too decomposed now, but the boat would still be there. As I've said time and time again, there is no concrete evidence to suggest the boys were on the boats that night or were ever even on the lake at all. All we know is that they went missing, so did two boats, and a gas tank was found directly south of Pickering 14 days later. That is it. Everything else is speculation. It's unclear to me if Durham Police are still considering this an open investigation, but I don't think they'd turn down any tips about the case if they came their way, so I'll leave the number in the description box along with the number for Crime Stoppers who can receive anonymous tips. Or you can contact Bruce Ricketts, the private investigator, directly at lostboys.tipline@gmail.com. A few years ago, Lindsay's Law in Canada led to the creation of a new DNA-based National Missing Persons Database, which provided new hope that one of the boys will one day be identified. All they need is one identification to provide even a vague answer in this case. Each year, the boys' families gather at Frenchman's Bay to remember them, writing messages on balloons to their loved ones and laying out flowers on the beach. Family and friends raised funds to install a commemorative bench at the foot of Liverpool Road, and with the remainder, made a donation to the International Centre for Missing and Exploited Children. It's important to keep this case in the minds of people, especially in the minds of locals in Pickering, as someone might have information that could provide answers to the grieving families. I do think the lake needs to be searched properly, and I understand what a feat that would be, but with publicity and public fundraising, surely it could be done. I think we'd all be willing to donate to the cause. I know I would. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys. Sorry, I know the video ends there, but I was actually checking the Facebook page as I was editing this video, and I've realised there's actually been an update. When I was writing the script for this, they hadn't put anything on the Facebook page since about October last year, but just 2 days ago, so on the 6th of April, they updated it saying there is now a website where they're going to sort of collate all the information, so everything is going to be in one place, really easy to find, really easy to navigate, and there's also an option on there for you to support the investigation and donate. So I'll be donating a portion of the profits of this video towards that, and hopefully some of you might be able to afford to as well. I'll leave it linked down below just in case you want to go and help. And with that, I'm really going now. Thanks for watching, guys. Bye.